Welcome to Copyright Clearance Sales Podcast Series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It's Valentine's Day, Friday, February 14th, 2020. Our guest on the show is Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer who joins me every Friday with news and insights on publishing and reading. Welcome back, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So indeed, welcome back and bienvenida as you have just returned from a sojourn in Madrid, Spain. What business sent you there?
Tapas. Well, no, sure. Yeah, thank you for the welcome home. I appreciate that. You know, I was in Spain for the annual meeting of our Pub Magnet Group, which is an association of international trade publishing magazines from around the world. We've spoken about this group in the past years. Well, long and short of it is that each year we get together to share information about the book business in our respective countries and to look for some ways that we can work together. For example, we do the CEO talks at Frankfurt together, and this year we're going to be doing one at the London Book Fair as well. You know, it was a few days of intense education. The meeting was in Madrid, so I did, in fact, indulge in a lot of tapas, but I also learned quite a bit about the complexity of the Spanish market, not just in Spain, but of course in Latin America and around the world. And we also just got the usual state of the markets roundups from other countries. And, you know, I guess I can wrap it all up thusly. Around the world, the book business is, for the most part, pretty well flat, at least in the mature markets. And that's fine. You know, it's funny, I've been a part of these meetings for the better part of a decade now. And depending on the state of the economy, the book business really earns its reputation as a mature business. Not much growth when it grows, and not much decline when it declines.
And you may have been away from New York, but that didn't keep you from continuing to cover, even from Spain, the Audible Captions case, which appears to have finally wrapped up with the filing with the court of a settlement agreement. Some outlets have portrayed the outcome as a total victory for the publishers. What's your sense?
You know, it may well be a fairly big victory for the publishers. The problem is we just don't know because the party's final settlement document under seal. You know, given the high profile nature of this case, that seems a little unsatisfying to say the least. You know, if not out of character with the Amazon-owned Audible, because they put non-disclosures on everything. But in a late twist this week, the judge in the case, Judge Valerie Caproni, struck a blow for transparency. She denied the party's bid to file the final settlement under seal, giving them until next Friday, the 21st of February, to submit a list of proposed redactions and their reasons for wanting those redactions. And she let us know in her order that she is not really inclined to grant many redactions, writing that she saw, and I'm quoting here, nothing in the settlement that would, you know, more or less deserve to be redacted. She also gave the parties an interesting choice. They could decide not to retain the court's jurisdiction and submit just a permanent injunction that would remove all references to a settlement agreement, and the court would then enter the permanent injunction without retaining control or enforcement over that agreement. But that could be a bigger deal than it might seem for the parties here.
And the fact that there's a settlement amount suggests, as you wrote on Thursday, that someone is getting paid.
Yeah, that could be a very big deal. Now, it might just be attorney's fees, but in Caproni's order denying the settlement to be filed under seal, she referenced a settlement amount. And it could just be the cost of attorneys here. But again, even if Audible, for example, agreed to pay the publisher's attorney's fees, which I'm sure are pretty significant for this litigation, that would be a victory. Because the program never launched, so there really is no damages here. And frankly, it sure seems to me from the beginning that Audible sort of goaded the publishers into this suit. So paying their fees would not only seem fair, it would seem like, you know, a victory.
And what exactly has Audible agreed to in this settlement that's public, at least?
Well, what we know is that Audible has agreed not to include the copyrighted works of the seven plaintiff publishers in its captions program, I should say, without express permission. And that's what's public. It's public through a brief proposed stipulated consent permanent injunction filed with the court. Now, if that permanent injunction is approved, Audible has agreed basically to be permanently restrained from, you know, using AI to generate text, from actually generating text in any way from audiobooks of the publishers or for any product or service created by Audible. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky. Only the seven named plaintiffs that sued Audible in this action are covered by that permanent injunction. But there was apparently language in the settlement document that we have not seen that extends the same protection to of that injunction, of that permanent injunction, to all AAP members. In a brief statement, AAP President and CEO Maria Pallante said that, and I'll quote her here in her statement, Audible has agreed that it will obtain permission from any AAP members that are in good standing with AAP before moving forward with Audible captions for their works. How exactly that works, I don't know. And where does it leave all the other publishers out there? That's a big question too, right? Because, you know, the IBPA, for example, the indie publishers, they carried water on this. They really did. And where are all their indies left if they're not part of the AAP? And what does it mean to be in good standing? What if you're an AAP member who's, you know, for some reason not in good standing at the moment? But what really stood out to me is that I can't help but wonder if Audible did what it said it was going to do last October, and that's moot the suit. And I say this because Audible sources actually confirmed to PW on background that the company is not moving forward with a captions program, at least not beyond this limited pilot that it started with public domain works for students. Public domain works, of course, are free to be used. They require no permission at all. And I have to say, I'm really not surprised, because if there was one thing in this litigation that was crystal clear to me, it's that the AI that Audible uses here for captions is just not ready for prime time. Further, Audible officials said the company has in fact decided not to include any copyrighted works in the captions program without securing permission. So we don't have a program that's launching, and if it does launch, they're going to look for permission. And that, of course, is regardless, Audible insisted, regardless of whether or not the parties are members of AAP or not. Now, the company was careful to stress that they've not formalized that decision with any party outside of this litigation, but that's their position, that any copyrighted work that's going to be part of a captions program that may or may not launch in the future would require permission. And I think that's a big deal, too, because while Maria Pallante is releasing a statement saying she struck a deal to protect AAP members, Audible is saying that there's nothing to be protected from. You know, did they, in fact, moot the suit here? It's going to be interesting to see what the final settlement agreement says about this if it's ultimately filed and made public.
Now, wait, if it is filed, you just said, are you suggesting the settlement may not be final?
You know, I have no basis to speculate on that for sure. Certainly a settlement here, I think, would be the most expeditious and smart solution for this whole thing, for both parties, really. But if there's a lot of information in that settlement that Audible or Amazon or even the publishers perhaps don't want to be public, they could decide to walk away from it and to, you know, just file the permanent injunction or possibly even litigate it further. I mean, you have to wonder, if there is no captions program, and I've spoken to a number of lawyers about this, there really isn't a suit. And while the publishers might very well win the preliminary injunction that they've asked for, you know, you'll remember they had a hearing in September of last year where Judge Caproni threw a lot of cold water, shall we say, on Audible's fair use defense. So if the publishers end up winning that preliminary injunction, well, what's the big deal? The program isn't going forward anyway, and the broad strokes of what's in that preliminary injunction are what they've agreed to in this permanent injunction as part of the settlement. You know, and lawyers also tell me that, you know, Audible does, in fact, have a good chance of getting the larger copyright suit tossed as defective if they were to litigate further. So remember, Audible officials argued that this was a, you know, breach of contract case because they have license agreements with all the publishers here, and that has to be pled before they can get to a copyright infringement case. Now, honestly, I can't imagine this dragging out. Audible is, you know, not moving forward with captions. The publishers got what they wanted, which is an acknowledgement that permission is needed. What are we really fighting about here, right? This should be finalized. But here's the other thing, too, that sticks out about this to me, and that's that AAP officials had some pretty tough language and statements at the start of this litigation, and other outlets with this settlement have been quick to say it's a total victory for AAP, but AAP hasn't said that publicly, and I wonder why. You know, it likely has something to do with the relationship between the publishers and the Audibles, and Audible, excuse me, which is, of course, owned by Amazon. But if this was a total victory, I don't know, I'd want to shout this from the rooftops. So, you know, I take from that there probably still are a few sensitive elements in play here.
And finally, Andrew, another year of the Trump administration and another proposal to cut arts and library funding. What do you make of that?
Yes, 4 for 4. This week we learned that the Trump administration has once again proposed shutting down the Institute for Museum and Library Services, through which all federal library funding flows through grants to states. Also proposed cutting the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities. Not a surprise. This has happened every year of the Trump administration. Every year of the Trump administration, however, those agencies have actually survived, and IMLS actually has gotten pretty significant bumps in its funding over those 4 years. So Congress is very much still on board with keeping those organizations alive. But here's what's different this year. Everything. You know, the Trump administration running for re-election here. We've just seen them beat impeachment. We have a deficit and a national debt that is ballooning. At some point, someone is going to have to take this seriously, right? We can't just keep giving funding increases to the agencies that Trump's proposing cutting. You would imagine that at some point they're going to start taking him seriously. And that's the message that ALA, the American Library Association, is giving to its members. Don't sleep on this. Don't think that just because we've survived the last 4 years and have actually worked and gotten funding increases, that that just happened overnight. That required a lot of work. That required a lot of advocacy one-on-one with, you know, rank and file librarians, with authors, with their Congress representative. And, you know, if that doesn't happen, you could wake up one day and find that we don't have these programs. So stay vigilant. That's the message I'm getting from the arts community and from the library community. And we'll see what happens.
And when it does happen, we'll get the reporting and analysis from Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer. Andrew, thanks for joining me today and every Friday on Beyond the Book.
My pleasure, as always.
Up next on Beyond the Book, the largest book fair in the Western Hemisphere doesn't happen in New York or even in Los Angeles, but in a Mexican city known as the birthplace of tequila and mariachi, and for being home to a thriving high-tech community. The Guadalajara International Book Fair, known by its Spanish acronym as PHIL, is the second largest book fair in the entire world next to Frankfurt, as Edward Nowotka, international editor for Publishers Weekly, explains.
Well, you have essentially the entire Spanish-speaking world converges on Guadalajara. Every year for what is bar none the biggest book publishing event. It's also a public fair, so you do have you know, lots and lots of school children, busloads of people. It goes on for approximately a week.
Spanish books on show in Guadalajara, next on Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.